The Gospel reading for today from the Gospel according to St. Mark. Jesus said, "The kingdom of God is as if someone would scatter seed on the ground and would sleep and rise night and day, and the seed would sprout and grow, he doesn't know how. The earth produces of itself, first the stalk, then the head, then the full grain in the head. But when the grain is ripe, at once he goes in with his sickle because the harvest has come." Jesus also said, "With what can we compare the kingdom of God, or what parable will we use for it? It is like a mustard seed, which, when sown upon the ground, is the smallest of all the seeds on earth. Yet when it is sown, it grows up and becomes the greatest of all shrubs and puts forth large branches, so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shade." With many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. He did not speak to them except in parables, but he explained everything in private to his disciples. May we be blessed by the hearing and now the interpretation of the word. One of the blessings of getting to go with Maria to London when she teaches for SMU in London is the unprecedented and unparalleled access we get to a lot of various English institutions. At Stonehenge, for instance, most visitors are kept off the grounds. They are carefully shepherded to surround the perimeter. They're kept behind the velvet ropes. The SMU students, however, get to go right inside, right into the center of the stone rings, provided, of course, that they don't touch anything while they're there. And thus far, we've managed to keep the sophomores' grubby little hands off the stones, so we're able to go back year after year. Another place to which the program gets remarkable access is Parliament. Now, like our own capital in Washington, D.C., the palaces of Westminster are flooded with tourists, especially with school children who often go to Parliament on field trips to learn how parliamentary democracy works. Unlike a lot of those younger school children, however, the SMU students on the program get to actually meet with a member of Parliament. In our case, the member of Parliament welcomes us to a private committee room and gives a short lecture and then shares his views on the current state of affairs, both in Britain and the United States. The particular MP with whom we happen to meet is a Roman Catholic who represents the constituency of Canterbury. Now, this is somewhat unusual because Canterbury is itself the spiritual heart of the Church of England, which took pride in throwing off the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I mention this only because the Member of Parliament himself makes a point of sharing this part of his story. So in the course of the question and answer session that followed his brief presentation, a student asked him how his Roman Catholic faith affects his politics, how he conducts his business as a Member of Parliament. And the gentleman answered the question by saying that his faith does not, in fact, inform his politics because, as he reads it, there is no political program in the New Testament. Well, at that point, Maria and I had to grab each other's hands in order to keep from falling off our seats because, I don't know, there's something about the phrase kingdom of God that Jesus preaches about that looks an awful lot like a political program to us. Never mind the fact that saying Jesus is Lord is a political statement because it's saying that Jesus and not Caesar runs the place. Well, this particular gentleman is not alone in his views. Earlier this year, I met with a group of women. These women were very concerned about the direction in which our country is headed. They were particularly concerned about the role in our society played by immigrants who happen to be Muslim. It seems that these women were alarmed by the degree to which Islam affects the everyday lives of Muslims, everything from praying five times a day to governing what they can and cannot eat. Well, I listened to this for a moment, and then I said, well, don't you think that Jesus ought to affect every aspect of our lives as Christians? Oh no, they replied, Jesus is just for our spiritual lives. Jesus has nothing to do with politics. Well, friends, let me say this morning that if that is your position, that Jesus has nothing to do with politics and that there is no political program discernible in the New Testament, you have a right to that opinion. You are perfectly entitled to it. It is apparently a view that is commonly held, and I think that it is widely held as a byproduct of the American principle of the separation of church and state. As good constitutional Republicans, small R Republicans, that is, many of us have been taught to strictly maintain Thomas Jefferson's wall of separation between church and state. Jefferson's fictive wall was meant to ensure that the church kept properly to its sphere of affairs, which Jefferson believed were primarily private and moral, and that the state would keep properly to its sphere of affairs, which Jefferson believed to be public and regarding actions, not thoughts or opinions. Fair enough so far as it goes. Jesus, however, knew no such distinction. Jesus didn't know a distinction between public and private, between church and state, or religion and politics. Both of those are Enlightenment-era ideas. For Jesus and his fellow Jews, synagogue and state, religion and politics had long been intertwined. For as long as human beings had existed in relationship to the God who had created them, those human beings had been governed by God. All of the covenants that God had made with Noah and his family, with Abraham and Sarah, with Jacob and his sons, with Moses and the children of Israel, all of those covenants made clear that God was king. That God was in charge, that God got to make the rules. To worship God was to obey God, and to obey God was to worship God. God was king, and therefore the earth amounted to the kingdom of God, where God sought to bring about God's rule, a rule of love and justice and peace and mercy. But things took a turn. You may recall from last week's reading from 1 Samuel, in which the old prophet laments that the children of Israel no longer want to have God as king. Samuel and God both lament this decision because it represents a rejection of God as ruler. Young Israel wants to be like all the other nations of the world and have a king to lead them in war and to decide matters of justice. God just wasn't doing the trick anymore. It's not you, God, Israel said, it's us. It's not anything really that you've done. It's just where we are in our life and all the other lame relationships Israel could think of to offer as an excuse to end the relationship. So Samuel anointed Saul to be Israel's king. Now that was last week. Today we fast forward through the whole of Saul's reign as king and learn that God was very sorry that God had made Saul king over Israel. God has decided to pick a new king. So God sends the prophet Samuel to a man named Jesse, one of whose sons God has selected to be Israel's new king. So, one by one, Jesse has his sons appear before Samuel, beginning with the oldest, who was the presumed front runner on account of his towering height. Ah, thinks Samuel, surely this is the Lord's anointed, and my work here is done. Wrong, God says. Next, please. And so it went through seven of Jesse's sons, and God's response to each was exactly the same. Nope. Next, please. Well, when they've run out of candidates and God still hasn't made his selection, Samuel turns to Jesse and says, sorry to bother, but do you have any other sons? Yes, Jesse says, but only the youngest, and I can't imagine that you would want him. He's keeping the sheep. In other words, he's doing the menial farm work that can safely be entrusted to any child of average abilities. I mean, sure, David was ruddy, and he had beautiful eyes, and he was very good-looking, but that hardly qualified him to do the arduous work of statecraft. He's the one, God said to Samuel, rise and anoint him, which made for a very surprising choice. David is a surprising choice to be king because, so far as we know, David meets very few, if any, of the criteria we normally employ in looking for a leader, someone with strong character and bold ideas, a clear 7-point plan to create jobs, lower taxes, protect the border, and reduce crime. David was the youngest of 8 brothers, presumably the littlest. Probably had been picked on, was maybe the runt of the litter. He was clearly the least experienced in public affairs and completely without a clue as to how properly to stimulate the economy. The only contest David was likely to win was as Bethlehem's most eligible bachelor. And yet David was God's choice to be king of Israel. Which, to my way of thinking, just goes to show how God often chooses very surprising people or places or things by which to do God's will. Now, if you know David's story, you know that the little shepherd boy goes on to slay a giant, which leads to Israel defeating their enemies, the Philistines, which in turn is but the first of many military victories over Israel's enemies for David, which is how he finally gets crowned as king. If you're to ask St. Paul how it is that a little shepherd boy rises to the top like that, the apostle might remind you that God chooses what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing the things that are. It's so easy for God to work with the little people, the people without much money or formal education or, frankly, a lot of Bible training, because those people tend to believe God when God speaks to them. And it's so much easier for God to work in the little places, in summer camps or in homeless shelters or in the world's developing nations, because no one tends to get confused about who is at work in those settings. And it's so much easier for God to work with the little things like mustard seeds and the birds of the air or the lilies of the field because, frankly, they don't require a lot of explanation. The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, Jesus said, which was a surprising choice because, as Jesus noted, it is the smallest of all the seeds, and even when it does grow to full maturity, it's still a shrub. If you're going to draw botanical parallels to the kingdom of God, you probably want sturdy oaks or stately elms or towering pines. Surely we want people to get the idea that the kingdom of God, God's reign, God's work in God's world to bring about the world as God intends it, ought to be something strong and powerful and mighty. But Jesus goes with the mustard seed, which, when it is planted, grows up and becomes the greatest of all shrubs and puts forth large branches so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shade. As I say, a surprising choice, but I think Jesus chooses the mustard seed to illustrate the nature of God's kingdom because, like the shepherd boy David, it's perfectly easy to overlook. The mustard seed is so small, so unprepossessing, that you're not likely to notice. Nobody's likely to notice a group of fifth grade boys at Franklin Elementary School in Mankato, Minnesota. At their age, you could forgive the boys for not getting involved in stopping the bullying of another classmate. You might even expect that they would join in the bullying. You see, James has learning disabilities and talks in a halting way and isn't very coordinated. He was adopted as a baby from a foreign country, and his dad died in a bicycle accident when he was six. James is the classic target for the meanness of young children. But five boys in his class have bounded together to make James one of their gang. They tie his shoes when they become untied, and they eat lunch with him, and they throw him the football so that he can make the winning play. The boys have even pooled their allowances in order to buy James a PlayStation and play video games, which he's never done before. The James gang has made a surprising choice. They've suspended all the normal rules about how and you and I are to succeed in life, to pick the smartest or fastest or richest or coolest kid to be their friend, to do whatever is clever or easy or to their own advantage, to exclude the weak and the marginalized in order to get ahead. The James gang haven't done that. Instead, the James gang chose the littlest and the least and the weakest and the marginalized, and they have made him their friend. They've done what is both hard and hardly to their own advantage. They purposefully include James, who is weak and marginal, and they place him at the center of their circle where he can be loved and protected and cared for. Somewhere along the line in these little lives, a seed was planted. And that seed has blossomed and produced a beautiful bush in which one little bird has made a nest in its shade. I think the kingdom of God is something like that. Pretty surprising when you think about it.